Welcome to Night Search. This is Eddie Middleton in Memphis, Tennessee. And our guest co-host tonight, Augie Nost, out there in Tucson. Thanks for being on, Augie, and bringing on this most intensely interesting guest tonight. And I'm going to let you introduce him.
Okay, thank you. I would start with good morning, good evening, good night, or whatever it is in your part of the world. You have my greetings. Tonight we are going to see if we can enlighten ourselves a little bit. We will talk about the universal mind and us being part of that mind, how we can use this mind to create good things for ourselves and the world. To speak on that, I have with me tonight Tom Carroll. He is the author of the book, The Oracle Guidance for Growing a Soul. We will discuss something Tom calls the 10 Project, which is a method to develop surrender and unity with a higher power. By many people getting together in unity of mind, we create a mastermind with phenomenal powers in it. And Tom is going to be here to talk and speak how we can do this and how this can better the world we live in. With more, no more ado, I give you Tom Carroll. Welcome to the show here, Tom.
Well, good evening, Augie. Thank you for allowing me to be a guest tonight.
All right. Well, let's have some fun also. Life is too serious sometimes, so let's try to make this fun and we can learn something. Because I know you have a lot of experience. You've written a book there, and you're working on another one. Before we get into specifics, why there's always a reason why people do things, and what is your reason for focusing on specifically this thing about the 10 Project?
Well, it's been a progressive experience. Years ago, I listened to Art Bell, as so many of us did, and we heard him do his mass consciousness experiments. And as interesting as they were, we also heard Art in later years explain that he didn't want to do that anymore because he recognized the possibility of unintended consequences, things happening above and beyond what he and his audience were praying for, were thinking about in unity. So he tapped into something very powerful, but he recognized that it wasn't under his control, and so he backed away. Mm-hmm. I continued to think about that and realized that there should be a way to harness that power or allow ourselves to be used by that power. And, you know, I'm to say power, let me just to simply say God. People are allergic to the word. It means so many different things to different people, but to be clear, to be succinct, we'll just say God. So yeah. In listening to Art and continuing through, I decided that there were ways, discovered that there were ways, and that ends up being what I call the 10 Project.
Let me ask you this. You said that he backed away from it because he was afraid of unintended consequences. Now, how could it have had unintended consequences unless he was asking his audience to focus on something that was not maybe good?
Well, the problem is that when we are asked to agree about something, our different ideas about agreement, our ideas about agreement vary. When I ask that question, I explain very simply that, let's say you and I are going to pray for a friend. Let's say that Mary is sick and we want Mary to be well, so we agree to pray for Mary. Let's say we pray silently, separately, and then we get back together and we compare what we've said, what we prayed. And we'll both have prayed something good, but it will be different by some degree. Now, one of the elements in the 10 Project is developing coherence. And the importance of that is simply understood as the difference between a light from a lamp and a laser. Both are photons, light photons, but obviously a laser is incredibly more powerful than your reading lamp. Coherence is the difference. And by developing genuine agreement at depth, we make that leap from the reading lamp to a laser. Now, the important part is, how do you do that? And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that the only way that two people can ever actually agree in perfect synchrony is to surrender all of their ideas. I call it apositionality, no position. And this is this idea of surrender couples directly with coming together with the prayer of agreement, two or more people. The mechanics of it are this, is that there is a way to learn your way into deep surrender, wherein you've given up all your ideas about God, all your ideas about good or bad, and in the case that I just mentioned, let's say Mary Sue, we surrender our ideas about what should happen with Mary Sue. Maybe she won't live through this. We have to give up all of our ideas about what's good and bad and what's going to happen to Mary Sue.
And then what would you be praying for?
Pardon?
If you give up all your ideas about what outcome you want, how can you be said to be praying for anything specific?
Well, there ends up being a fundamental goodness about the universe. It confounds Buddhists, for instance, who are specifically agnostic at best, if not, you know, disbelievers in the existence of a higher power of God. But in spite of that, they recognize that when they enter emptiness, profound silence, the emptiness, there is a goodness about it that's unexplainable. And so we simply recognize that God is good, that the divine energy that has manifested all things, consciousness and all the beings that are in the world, self-referentially conscious or not, there is a goodness that underlies this whole creation that we live in. So what we're doing is simply surrendering to goodness and essentially appealing to goodness to do whatever it wishes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now, in a case like that, you do indicate a category like Sue, you know, Mary Sue. I mean, you wouldn't just say surrender to goodness universally, and you had in mind helping Mary Sue originally.
That's correct.
Yeah,
however, what you have to realize is that this God that we're appealing to, divine consciousness, knows all these things, knows exactly what we're there, what business we intend to transact. And we simply allow that universal knowledge to appreciate, to respect the fact that we're there for Mary Sue. However, and specifically as we're doing this, we just give it up and we allow fundamental goodness and omniscience to recognize what we're there for.
Okay.
However, my own experience is as you work your way into this, you finally you reach a point where you feel permission to pray. And it may be that you feel you sense at this depth that you can actually say something specifically about Mary Sue. My experience is that you're so connected at that point with the oneness, with divine goodness, that the prayer ends up being just an ever so subtle nudge of intention, and no more than just almost just a slight movement of the body. And that embodies all of the thought, all of the intention, Mary Sue included.
So what we're doing, we are basically giving it up to the higher power, so to speak, for what is best for Sue is what must happen.
That's right. Without any of our own lower egocentric ideas about what should happen, why it should happen, when it should happen.
So we're allowing for the master plan for Sue to fulfill itself.
Exactly. And we're lending the power that we are. The one thing that can be said that human beings own is the power to choose. Our lives are not under our control. We didn't choose to be born, at least at the level we think of ourselves as these personalities, Augie and Tom and whoever else. We didn't choose to be born. We don't know how long we'll live. But while we're here, we can choose. So the one thing that we own, this power of choice, is what we give up. And we give it up to divinity, which is all power, all knowledge, in all places at once, the three omnis. So it's the perfect marriage. It's a wonderful poetic synchrony between perfect power and this one thing that conscious, embodied consciousness human beings own, the power to choose. We give all to that which is already given all and continues to give all to manifest life.
Yeah, this starting to make sense.
Because,
this universal mind here that is actually also a part of God, so to speak. So what we are doing, we are interacting with ourselves and it and coming in a unity of mind so that we encompass everything there is and that will happen.
Well, something will happen.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get a better idea how this will actually work. Like, how many people would you need? 2, 3, 4, 10 to come together in one place and then get into like a state of meditation first or what?
There's a formula.
I'm sorry, Augie, say it again.
Yeah, there's kind of a formula for this, actually, when they say that when two or more minds are united in harmony, they create a third mind that has the potential mind power of the two or more of them multiplied by each other. So if you had 10 people, that actually could have the mind power of 100 people, if there's 10 that gets together.
Yeah, well, whether we can actually depend on, you know, specific mathematical equations, specific numbers, I don't know. But what I'm drawing on all through this are principles that people have tested, used, and intuited. The Jewish men and women, for instance, pray in groups of 10, called a minyan. And so that's why I call this the 10 Project. And it turns out, interestingly enough, that 10 is the number of birds, for instance, that it takes to develop the flocking phenomenon that you see, a group of birds doing the fantastic swoops and swirls that we see, or fish, the same thing in the ocean. The math behind this is recognized as the same math behind a smoke ring, the toroidal form. And that is the lowest order geometric form that is self-referential. Now, there's more about that. There's a reason for that. But specifically, answering your question specifically, how many people, I'm positing that 10 is probably the minimum. Now, the more you can get, the better. However, you have this fundamental problem in getting even two people to agree, to understand the depth of surrender that's required. But let's say, theoretically, hopefully, you can gather 10 people that really understand it and do, and you used a correct term, the other gentleman on the call. Forgive me, your name again is, please?
Eddie.
Hi, Eddie. I'm sorry, I didn't realize there would be the three of us, so it's nice to meet you.
The third mind right there.
there you go.
Okay, so you suggested, or you asked, you know, do you get into a meditative state? And I guess the idea would be that spending time, and it does take time to relax into, learn your way into, feel your way into this depth of surrender that's required, is that time, that meditative time, preparatory to anything actually happening. So yes, the group would come together. Now, seeing as how we know there really is no such thing as time or distance in what we call a spirit, then we wouldn't really have to be together. But certainly as you're learning your way into this, it would help to be face-to-face with as many as possible.
Yeah, let me ask you this.
I know you've done a lot of research apparently on this, and there are many cases where this has been demonstrated to work. Could you cite a few instances, you know, for our audience that you know of, that you could, it's documented where the powerful results have been obtained by doing this?
Actually, no. And that's why I call it a theory. And I,
well, what about Art Bell's experiment? Yeah. What about that?
Well, you say have I, and no, personally, as I pulled all these different elements together and refined them as distinct from what Art Bell has did in the past, no, I have not had the opportunity to employ the 10 project specifically. But just as you mentioned, we do know from Art's experience that it does work. He did it several times. He had an audience that numbered upwards of 3 million on a given night. And that power of united intent was shown to be incredibly powerful. Rain, where there hadn't been rain. And I believe Augie knows of some other, you know, the specifics of some of the other experiments. But yeah, that's the one that I remember in particular. And I believe hurricanes were mentioned. He was afraid, for instance, that if they focused on a hurricane that was headed for Tampa St. Pete, that it would miss and you know, it wouldn't hit Tampa St. Pete, but bear off and maybe wipe out St. Myers. So yes, it has been demonstrated in a variety of ways, but not in this way that I'm describing, that sidesteps these potential unintended consequences. And the other aspect of it is that what Art was doing was a one-off. And what we're looking for, another element of the 10 Project, is something that takes on a life of its own. Actually, as I was thinking about this, a large part of my thinking was that given the degree of confusion that's in the world today, this would be a wonderful time for a messianic event. And you don't have to be Christian to talk about a Messiah. All of the major religions, from Islam to Judaism and Buddhism, Hinduism, all have a messianic story. They're looking for some figure to show up and set things right. Now, my thought was that the Jesus of the Bible, for instance, probably wouldn't be interested in coming and sweeping up a whole bunch of people that were still all fighting with each other and confused. As we read the Old Testament, for instance, we're told that we're supposed to do our homework, as I say. We're yep. supposed to use our time well to come into the fullness of this salvation, as it's called, and to mature in our relationship with the divine. So what I'm thinking is that this messianic event, when it does happen, it may not be an individual figure. Probably, most certainly not Jesus on a white horse with a flaming sword coming out of his mouth. We understand that to be figurative language. Yeah. But now, as we recognize the potential for individuals to come together and fulfill these scriptural injunctions, we realize that there very possibly is this sort of deep agreement in prayer and surrender and a very real hope for the future of mankind.
Yeah, that makes sense. Can you imagine? Give me your thought on what we could do if we had spread this out, so we had 1 million, 2 million, 8 million, 10 million people doing this. Let's say twice a week. What do you think could be done?
Well, that's the inevitable question. But the interesting thing about it is that it contradicts one of the primary tenets of the whole experiment. Mm-hmm. If we come into it positing what could be, should be done, then we've messed it up from the beginning. However, I think it's intuitively clear that if larger and ever larger numbers of people came together at this depth of surrender, trusting in divine goodness, really good would happen. There's something that, you know, we touched on, and I didn't complete the thought, was the idea that this should not be a one-off event. And I mentioned the smoke ring, the torus. The interesting thing about the toroidal form is that it rolls in on itself and then comes back out complete and whole and keeps going. Now, of course, in the case of the smoke ring, after a time, it does dissipate if you don't add more energy. But in this experiment, the indications are, and depending on how far we get in the conversation tonight, the reason for having a group of 10 or more is that by having that much participation, that much information in the system, you get a phenomenon that takes on a life of its own.
Yeah.
So that it wouldn't just stop with these 10 people. Now, how that would carry forward, I don't know. Again, we're talking a theory. It hasn't been tested at this depth yet. But one of the tenets, again, is enough people, coming together with this like mind, surrendered mind, so that whatever does happen, like the Taurus, like the smoke ring, begins to take on a life of its own. To the first iteration, rolls in on itself and comes out ready to do it again.
Yeah, that's what I meant, actually. This self-aware universe or God, it is, like you said, it is inherently good. So if we put it to work for the goodness of mankind, things would start correcting itself towards what is more good, wouldn't it? So that's what I kind of meant, but what could actually happen?
Well, it's so tempting, of course, to think and speak that way, and I understand completely what you mean. I would adjust that slightly by saying that it's really divinity itself, God, God is verb, that's using us and has been waiting all this time for us to figure out that this sort of a partnership, this marriage made in heaven, is the very thing that divinity has been waiting for in manifesting self-referential conscious beings, that's us, human beings, and then asking us to give over, to partner with divinity. Now, what would happen, we don't know, but just as you're suggesting, as anybody would intuit, it's going to be good.
Yeah. There is actually some scientific experiments that actually prove physically, through physics, that this works, and that one of them is the Princeton egg. You heard about that one, I'm sure.
Yes, and very, very familiar. And let me ask you, how do you specifically mean that it relates to this?
Because they show that the mass consciousness can affect something at a distance.
Yes, I think a good part of their experimentation was that. And, of course, what they also showed was that that human consciousness was aware in advance of any significant events, like the Twin Towers, for instance. No, well, there was a small group, unfortunately, but people in general had no idea that it was coming. And yet these random number generators all over the world began to jump off the map minutes before it actually happened. So consciousness, of course, is, and what we are fundamentally, is spread across the whole universe. We are all places at once. So we do know what's coming. Now, that does figure in, but I'll have to admit I get a little bit lost when we jump out that far that quick.
Yeah, but that actually makes perfect sense to me, because outside of the three-dimensional physics, then we have no space and time. So that could make sense, because afterwards we all knew it. But since there is no space and time, everything is at that moment, then it can you can have the reaction before it happens. So that makes sense.
Yes, you're right. It's interesting where we end up in it, and it's hard not to, drifting away from the specific topic, the Penn Project. But all of this comes together in the fact, the underlying fact of oneness, a term that's just tossed about loosely, but it's real. And of course, it has everything to do with who we are, where we're going, what's really happening. There's so many ways that you can approach this. But anyway, the 10 Project.
Yeah.
Tell us about your book, the title of your book again.
The book is The Oracle Guidance for Growing a Soul. And it's a book that's instructional in nature. It plays off of Ramana Maharshi's question, actually not just his, but all the way back to Socrates and coming forward. Luminaries, our spiritual teachers, have always asked us to know who we are, know ourselves. So
yeah.
The oracle asks the question, who are you? And it asks from a variety of questions. It asks you to put yourself in a variety of thought experiments. And in these different situations and conditions, who are you? Directing you in such a way that as to break down identification with the specific personality. I'm not my name. I'm not my personal history. But underneath those things, there's something else. And what is that? And stepping back deeper and then stepping back again, who are you? Who is it that persists when all of these other things fall away? We can lose parts of our body, all too graphic, but I can cut off a finger, and I'm still here, and we can go farther, and I'm still here. All the family that I identify can leave this world, but I'm still here. All the different conditions in life that I identify with change, but I am still here. Now, who am I? So that's what the book is, and it's an invitation to enter into a series of exercises that help a person, as I say, break the identification with ego-centered self and finally recognize and more than intellectually recognize to experience this fundamental condition of consciousness that is who we are. People ask me about it and the temptation is, well, and they say, well, just tell us. And I say, well, I could tell you. I know the answer, but even knowing the answer myself doesn't do me any good. We need to experience it. And
yeah.
It's instructive to draw use the picture of a person in a darkened room, totally dark, and the one thing they know is that somewhere in the room there's a snake. And so they dare not move for fear of bumping up against the snake, getting bitten. It's a poisonous snake, by the way. And while they're in this situation, the lights come on. Just for an instant, the lights come on and then they go off. And in that instant, you see that it wasn't a snake. It's just a coil of rope. The lights have gone back out, but forever after, you're no longer afraid of the snake. And so that's why I say that knowing the answer to who are you doesn't do us any good. But having the experience of seeing the snake changes everything. Now we're no longer afraid.
No.
And that's the case with knowing, experiencing who we are. Suddenly you realize that you really are not alone. You really are all that is. Therefore, there is no reason to be afraid, to feel afraid, to feel separated. All the negative things that flow from this mistaken identity of a separate self.
That was an excellent analogy there. I like that. That makes sense. Knowledge and experience, that pretty much cures all and everything that is ill in our mind, I think.
Well, we have to know things first, and in knowing them, that gives us the courage and the stamina to push on. But ultimately, we need to experience these things for ourselves.
Yeah.
And
we're up at the top of the hour here, so maybe you could give the listeners a website where they possibly can get a hold of you and also have a look at this book, and I think it would be a good thing if they read it, because they would be, again, more enlightened.
Okay. Well, rather than their website, let me just simply give an email address. The website is sacredspace.org, just like it sounds, sacredspace.org. And you can reach me at tom@sacredspace.org, my email through that website. Or my Twitter address is @WriteTomCarroll. So @WriteTomCarroll for Twitter, or tom@sacredspace.org.
Okay. Good. Now, you've been thinking about this 10 project for quite a while. When you have discussed it with other people, what kind of reactions do you get?
I get puzzled looks. It's been really difficult for people to appreciate the nature of surrender at the depth that I'm talking about, apositionality. And that's why I do, as with yourself, I referred them to the car passing trick, which you can find, by the way. I've posted that on sacredspace.org. In the list of articles, you'll see the car passing trick. And that gives a person a very good picture of what profound surrender really means. You can't trick it. You can't game it. You really have to surrender. And rather than me trying to take our valuable time here trying to talk our way into that, I would simply recommend that listeners go to sacredspace.org and take a look at the car passing trick. It's well known. You can actually Google it just like that and pull it up from a variety of sites as well, the car passing trick. But you ask me how people react, and one of the funny things is that the proposition is to come together in agreement. And almost universally, when I bring this up, people want to add something to it, if not talk about something completely different. But rather than coming into, beginning with an attitude of agreement and cooperation, people almost universally want to change it, to add something to it. And of course, that doesn't work. There's just sometimes when you got to do it according to the recipe book, or on your way to baking a cake, you come out with chewing gum. So, unfortunately, the way the condition that we find ourselves in today, people are so fractured and so determined to have their own way and do what they want when they want. It's very difficult for people to swallow, to agree. So, in all these years, I have rarely found anybody who understands the potential of what I'm talking about and is interested in learning more. The reason we're talking tonight is that I read your article, the one posted with Catherine Kerrigan, about the nature of prayer, and I realized that here was someone who understood that prayer is something to be taken seriously, and if done correctly, has a statistically significantly higher possibility of working. So, you got it, and I contacted you, and here we are talking.
Good. Yeah, I understand the concept, because it's been around, not in the West so much, but in the East. There are groups in China, Tibet, Japan, and places over there where people get together in houses, and they do these types of brainstorming sessions, which they call it, or prayer meetings, you know, what we would call it, and they do some really neat things with it, actually, because once you get unity, like you say, in surrender to the unity and the higher power, through the unity to the that higher power, it has a phenomenal power to it.
Well, there you go. It's so interesting. You know, we're all involved in our various worlds, and we consider ourselves these individual personalities. And for instance, tonight there's a little rain falling. But the truth is, the rain that I hear is not just falling on my roof. I am the rain. The stars that I see are actually inside of me. The world that I experience doesn't come at me. It's actually within me and coming from inside of me. Because, in fact, who I really am is who you really are. We're all places at all times.
We are one.
And I just got lost in that. What were we talking about?
It sounds like Hindu mysticism or metaphysics, like the Atman.
is the same as bonbon or something.
Yeah, the truth of it is, as I understand it, Eddie, is that there is what I call, what others refer as perennial wisdom. And at the heart of whether it be Islam or Buddhism or Christianity or Judaism, there is a core understanding that transcends the particular religious notions and dogma. And so what I'm talking about is the core that persists across time and culture, all of these. It is perennial, and it is profoundly wise, and it's the same. It does not change.
Yeah, we're past the top of the hour just now. I hope to at least invite some of our listeners, if they'd like to call in with a question, they could call us at 347-838-9142. That's 347-838-9142. We welcome you to call in and ask a question of our guest or make a comment.
And then you got to dial 1 to get into the chute where you can speak.
Oh, yes. They're not giving that cue anymore. So once you get in there, you have to dial 1 to get into the host cue.
Yep. Yeah, this is... what do you think, what kind of people do you think, if there are any differences in this arena, but what kind of people do you think will be mostly drawn to this? Do you think that will go across all sections of society, just a few that maybe be more attracted to it?
Well, we have to remember that as the scriptures tell us, all are called. They say all are called, but few are chosen. And people get the idea that that means that it's just a rarefied few, the special people. But all are called, and anyone can be chosen if you want to. And when you ask, someone asks who is a prime candidate for the 10 Project, you would suspect it would be someone who has a deep metaphysical or a deep meditative background. And that could be very well, but those same people could also be highly opinionated and not very much given to cooperation. So I imagine that grandmothers, for instance, who have been praying for their family and giving over their time and energy for years for others, would be just as qualified. People with deep concern for others and recognizing the value of surrender and the value of cooperation. Anyone with those appreciations, those characteristics, would be fine, prime candidates, and I would certainly welcome them.
Yeah. Let's say if people got together for, let's say, a session, what kind of results do you think could happen?
Well, we've come back to that question again, you know, what could happen? I don't know. And I think it's really important to simply say, we don't know. And that's a much more powerful, much more interesting, much more responsible response than you might think on the surface of it. Not knowing is at the heart of surrender, but trusting. As we've said, we've identified that God is good, that divinity, as it's manifest throughout the whole universe, is good. When we overlay our ideas on it, as we see in political structures and social movements and the interactions of any given individuals, that's where we begin to have problems. But when divinity is allowed to do what it wants, we have incredible manifestations of form in galactic shapes and stars and the way they all interplay and have made planets upon which life of all form and color and stripe can thrive. This fundamental goodness works itself out in so many ways. So why can't we trust? So you ask what could happen? Again, to preserve the integrity of the understanding, I think it's best to say, I don't know, but I trust that it would be good.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead, Doug. I had a question too, but go ahead.
Yeah. No, you go ahead. I got another one after you.
Yeah, I just want to bring in Plato and Socrates. You know, Plato says the ultimate truth is the good, and the ultimate goal of
the philosophical journey is to come to that knowledge of the good. And Socrates talked about that, the good things work out for the best. And he's talking about divine intelligence, making everything work out for the best. He trusted in that. So, and he always makes a point about not knowing. So could you maybe relate to what you're saying to Socrates and Plato?
Well, I didn't read the Greeks. I'm sorry, I am stunted. But we do know, hopefully people are familiar with the classic, The Cloud of Unknowing. And, of course, the author is unknown. But it forwards the idea that to step into this place of unity with the divine is to step into unknowing and trusting. A progressive experience with divinity wherein goodness just simply flows and the heart swells with feelings of well-being, with the fundamental knowledge that everything not only is but will continue to be okay. So unknowing, again, I think it's important to say that, you know, while it might sound irresponsible, it's actually the most responsible, the most mature in this context of responses and positions to trust in, well, the four-step, the 12-step programs call it the higher power, but to know that it's good, to trust that it's good, and finally give over. One of the things that we've seen, and something that keeps coming back to me, is that for all these hundreds and thousands of years, the best and brightest among us have tried to solve the world's problems, and we see the effect of that today. We haven't gotten very far. So isn't it time? And then we look at, well, remember Scripture, you know, depending on, you know, what your background is. And Scriptures say, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray, then I will hear them and I will turn and I will heal their land. So I hear this, and I remember other scriptures that are sitting there like seeds, and they've been waiting for us all this time to recognize that God wants nothing but good for us. The divinity, the life with a capital L, is nothing but good. And it's simply waiting for us to partner, to give over again, as we were talking before, give the thing that we have been entrusted with, this power of choice, to give it over to that which is continually giving all to us. And in that, then you have the actual manifestation of the reality of oneness, no longer separated from God, but one with. And then all the beauty that we've seen, that we do see around us at the micro and macroscopic levels, we're partnered with. And whatever flows then from this experience will be very interesting at a minimum and good.
If we were to do something like this, how often do you think it should be done?
Well, as often as possible. Let's talk about the a meditative discipline.
That was a trick question. That was a trick question, by the way. I knew the answer.
Okay. Well, it ends up being a good and useful question. As you begin to meditate, you realize that the meditation should never stop.
Right.
That the goal is, whether you're seated or walking around, that we should always be in the meditative frame of mind. So in this instance, to be more specific, we can and may well learn to be in a position, a mental, emotional position of surrender all the time. Now, I think, as listeners would have heard your question, how often should a group of people to get together and do this? Of course, that ends up being that you have to look at that in terms of how often is it practical for some group together to get together. And if you were lucky enough to do it once a week, you would be truly lucky. But again, what we're talking about is something that hopefully, theoretically, would take on a life of its own, and would begin to inform the group, inform the project as to. So what we have to remember is that we're talking about something that actually transcends our own ideas, so that just as when you're asking what could happen, I don't know. How often should it happen? I don't know. But we're giving ourselves over to that which does know. Does know what will happen, what should happen, when it should happen, knows when we should get together. And and the dynamics of this project are such that it would take on life of its own, and that we would walk around, let's say, in the surrendered state. Now, how that actually manifests, what we would see, once more, I don't know. But I think it'll work itself out.
Yeah. I think that's something that if this were to say I know people in every corner of the world, so, you know, it could spread out pretty fast. And I think it will take on a life of its own, because the people that are involved, I see no reason why they would not talk to like-minded people, and they would do the same. So it's kind of like the internet. You send out an email to 10 people on your, and there's 100, and third day you got 1,000 people seeing it. So this can happen.
It could. Of course, as you ask that and as we talk about it, you know, I think about, well, how are you going to keep it clean? And I think the answer to that is almost as soon as you get it together and see the first actualized experience of it successful, then you have to begin to take your hands off of it. And controller that I am, difficult as that would be, we just simply would have to watch it and see what it would do, see what would happen.
Yeah, I have a few more questions. What, now, of course, we're talking about having something that's really on a high spiritual plane, but what about somebody that's wanting to win the Powerball? Could he get a 10 group together to focus on winning the Powerball, or would that be something that would be blasphemous and not honored at all?
Well, it's not a question of blasphemous and not honored. The challenge, of course, one of the fundamental challenges is to step away from the idea of a God in the sky that's going to frown on us if we do something bad. But this whole business is, for lack of a better word, self-controlling, self-limiting. If you read the car passing trick, it very handily, very neatly explains why that can't happen. And to answer a little more specifically right here and now, as we've said, you can't walk into it with specific intentions. And wanting to win the Powerball, of course, would be trying to control it, and it just wouldn't work, because that's not surrender. Surrender says, I'm okay with winning or not winning. I give over.
I understand, yeah.
Yeah. But then again, at the tail end of that, you could say, I am okay with winning or not winning. And if I win, I will do all these good things for the other people of which is in need. Then the universe might step in and say, maybe there is something that extra that could be good from doing that. Do you think?
Well, there we have a perfect example of the human mind, and a good one in your case. But we always want to slip in a little bit of control.
Oh, yeah.
And so it doesn't work.
I know it.
It doesn't work. As we talked at the very beginning, one of the primary considerations is giving over our ideas of what is good. And that's a tough one. I mean, we're all convinced that we know what's good and what's best. And that's one of the reasons it's so difficult for people to enter into this, is because everyone's so convinced that they know better. However, who of us is really so arrogant as to say that we know better than the divine intelligence that spun galaxies throughout the whole of the visible and invisible universe? Do we know better than that? I'm sure we're all wise and humble enough to back up and say, no. One of the interesting things that happened, one of the experiences that moved me towards this whole thing, happened in Jerusalem at the wall, at the Wailing Wall. I was there on Yom Kippur, and here were these tens of thousands. I was there with a good friend of mine, and as people gathered and as evening descended, the darkness descended, and the lights came on around, but not enough to dispel the growing darkness. I had moved a little bit away from my friend, and I was standing there with my arms crossed, and I was a good Christian young man at that point, and I was looking at all these Jewish guys praying. Of course, the men are on one side, the women on the other. And I had this attitude of, if only they knew what we knew, that, you know, you can pray once and be forgiven. And, you know, the whole Christian dogma thing was running through my mind. When all of a sudden, this voice spoke up, a powerful voice from someone who was obviously at least 7, if not 8 feet tall, and commanded me, standing behind me, and commanded me and said, "Don't judge. You do not know what's happening. You don't understand what's happening." And I jumped and jerked and turned around, and there was nobody there. Just all the people who were crowding around me, and they had heard nothing. But I had been rung like a bell, and I was just shaking. Wow. I knew there was the energy that had come through that. It was so clear that this was messenger angel something. And so here I was just vibrating, shaking with this, and excited. I'd been reprimanded, but, you know, there's, well, being reprimanded by an angel is pretty cool if you take a right. So I worked my way back down to where Jane was standing, and before I could tell her what had happened, down on the prayer floor, a rabbi, he was maybe, well, I don't know, 30, 40 feet out there, and again, there were tens of thousands of people, and there were a couple of thousand men crowded down in this smaller marble floor area. This, you know, goes right up to the wall, and it's down about 8 feet from where we were standing. So down 8 feet and out about 30, here's this rabbi, and he's working with his men on this high holy day, most important day, and they've got to get everything taken care of for the whole year. But he stops, and he turns around, and he looks up into the crowd, and he picks his finger out and works back and forth until he singles me out, and he puts his finger in my face figuratively, points directly at me, looks directly at me, and says, "Do you know what's happening here?" Mirroring wow. exactly the words of this unseen angelic voice. Oh. And it gets weirder. He stopped. He completely stopped. You know, when he, you know, I just sort of, I mumbled and said, well, you know, basically, obviously, no. And so he tried to explain it, and he realized that across the distance in the crowd and the noise, he wasn't getting through. So he stops and works his way up through all these people. And it took him a good 5 or more minutes to work through the crowd. And he finally gets up to where I am, and he spends the next 30 minutes lecturing me, telling me, you know, exactly what's happening. The only thing I could remember him saying specifically was, "Tonight we are opening a portal between heaven and earth for all mankind." Now, he went on from there and began to say some stuff that was as chauvinistic as my thoughts, that essentially Judaism had it all together and nobody else really got it. But what stuck in my mind was that his words mirrored perfectly the voice of this, the words of this angelic messenger. "You don't know what's going on. But in the meantime, until you do, stop judging." So anyway,
they were surrendering according to this formula that you've been talking about.
Yes, essentially they were. You know, to what degree, you know, it doesn't matter. It was just a beautiful thing that they were doing. Yes, coming together in unity and praying.
Wow, it is, I guess, pretty evident that they get results when they do that.
Yeah. Well, considering that tiny Israel has been preserved against all odds for so many years, yeah, I think it might be working.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Extremely interesting interview here. Once again, could you give out a website and and how people could order your book?
Yeah, well, the book's available on Amazon.com, as is almost everything in print nowadays. You can read a little bit about the book on my website, sacredspace.org, sacredspace.org. Contact me, the website, or the email address through the website, tom@sacredspace.org, and I'd be happy to answer questions. And, of course, you can Twitter me, @WriteTomCarroll. My name is spelled with two R's and two L's, so that's Tom, the normal spelling, and Carroll, C-A-R-R-O-L-L, two R's and two L's, Write Tom Carroll.
And that's Write Tom Carroll at what again?
That's the Twitter address. You know, you have the at symbol, so @WriteTomCarroll. No spaces.
Oh, I got it. Got you. Okay. Wow. I think we've got time. Go ahead.
Easier, given the limitations of Twitter, just email me, tom@sacredspace.org.
Okay. So we got time maybe for one more question from somebody before we have to...
I got a quick one for you. Well, if you were going to start this, when would you want to start this?
Immediately. If people chose to contact me, if you and I, for instance, you and I and Eddie, chose to talk further and refine our understanding of surrender and go forward with that. That would be wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyone that's listening that chooses to contact, first I recommend Googling up the car passing trick or looking for it on, again, my website, sacredspace.org. But read that and understand this apositional surrender. It's a very interesting condition of the posturing of the human spirit. Deep surrender. There's nothing weak about it.
And always remember that it's been said that on the spiritual path, one has to slay the ego.
Well, there's a misunderstanding that comes with that. The ego is necessary. Without an ego, we're lost and you're essentially psychotic. We don't slay it, but we need to make it we need to be the master of it. You know, preserve it. A good, strong ego is necessary for spiritual development. We don't kill the ego. We need the ego. But we must stop allowing it to control us, and we control it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that makes a lot more sense, really, to me. Well, I guess we're about out of time. And thanks so much for being our guest, and I would like to get back with you again. I want to volunteer participate in this project when we can do that. And Augie, I'll let you and want to sign us off, Augie?
Yeah, this was interesting, and I loved your story at the end because that tells me that there is something special about this because it has a history of that dates back to, you know, several years and then back to Israel for one thing. So there's something special here, and that, I think, gives us another reason to at least take a second look at it and possibly get involved.
Wonderful. Well, I sincerely appreciate the opportunity to talk about the 10 Project tonight with yourselves and your audience. I appreciate you welcoming me on as a guest tonight.
Thank you. Thank you.
Talk to you soon again. Thanks for listening to Night Search.
Okay, good night, gentlemen.
Yeah, good night.
Night.